You've heard about the zombie apocalypse. That is, you know, millions of people roaming the earth and taking our money. None of those things is true. But the other big lie you hear, Amy, is that Social Security is bad. It's always been bad. It's never really worked. So that's the big lie they're pushing. And then they demonstrate it by cramming as many people into Social Security offices as they can for services that they used to be able to get online or used to be able to get on the phone. And that's going to be the evidence then that they create that it's always been bad. So, you know, we had to privatize it or we had to liquidate it. Here's your lump sum. Be happy. Go away. It was always a Democratic program that never worked. So that's what's going on here. And it's happening with a stunning speed that I think is Americans are waking up to.
And in the 10 seconds that we have left, this allegation that, you know, immigrants are being fraudulent in getting Social Security, they have paid into the system for years. It's their money.
Well, illegal immigrants, so-called people working here outside of legal status, cannot receive any Social Security benefits and never have been able to. They're prohibited by law. But they do pay in $25 billion for the benefit of the rest of us and into the Social Security Trust Fund. It's a total lie. Illegal immigrants do not receive Social Security benefits.
And yet they pay. Martin O'Malley, thank you so much for being with us, former Social Security Administrator.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area, and all over the world at kabu.fm.
Hi, this is Melissa Lesniak, the creator and host of That Vegan Show. On That Vegan Show, you will hear in-depth guest interviews on vegan-related topics, such as companion animals, environmentalism, social issues, and food and nutrition. We also learn about specific animals, such as possums and rabbits, including their needs and ways to help them. Be sure to tune in to That Vegan Show on the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. right here on KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's Farm Workers Union files suit to block ICE from raiding schools and churches.
University of Oregon student workers are on strike for higher pay.
And in international news, Russia declares a ceasefire in its war with Ukraine.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 28th, 2025. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Oregon labor and faith leaders are suing the Trump administration to block Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, from arresting people at churches, schools, and health clinics. It's led by Oregon's farm workers union, PICUN, and a handful of churches from Florida and California. When Trump took office, he removed an order that kept ICE enforcement from these sensitive locations. The lawsuit says Homeland Security violated First Amendment rights by bringing ICE into those spaces. The prior policy allowed people who feared deportation to still access medical care or pick their kids up from school. The lawsuit reads, quote, "As a result of the administration's new policy, sacred spaces have become sources of extreme anxiety rather than places of healing, expression, reflection, celebration, and refuge," end quote. The Trump administration has gone to extremes to push his immigration and deportation agenda. That includes defying court orders and deporting a group of Venezuelan immigrants to El Salvador prison without due process. A recent poll from the Washington Post and ABC News showed that a 53% majority of Americans disapprove of how Trump is handling immigration. That negative perception has grown over the past 2 months since the previous poll.
Some 4,000 University of Oregon student workers are on strike today. They've been unable to reach agreement with the university on three specific issues. That's worker pay, the grievance process, and the pay cycle. The student workers have a variety of jobs, including working in the dining hall, or as resident advisors, also known as RAs. The union wants to bring minimum pay up to $18.50 per hour. Currently, the average wage is around $15. The university offered a 5% salary increase in the first year of the contract and a 3% raise the second and third year of that contract. Student union bargaining co-chair Victoria Pinheiro said in a statement, quote, "Student workers are disproportionately first-generation college students and from lower-income families. The reason taxpayers support public universities is that public class and working class students can get an education, not just those from rich families. But U-O is making it impossible to work our way through college," end quote.
Portland State University has dropped all penalties against student pro-Palestinian protesters, but they say they didn't do it because of pressure from City Councilor Mitch Green. PSU's chapter of Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, or SUPER, was facing code of conduct violations for their role in pro-Palestinian protests last spring. SUPER organizers say those violations were unexpectedly dropped ahead of a scheduled meeting. Earlier this month, Portland City Councilor Mitch Green said he would vote against spending city money on a new performing arts center at PSU if the administration didn't drop the charges against the students. Green told the Mercury, quote, "A number of students spoke about a climate of repression of their free speech and of what felt like an overly punitive response to the protests last spring. If we're going to survive this period in history with democracy on the other end of it, that we've got to be willing to stand up for those of us who are putting it all on the line. I want to have their back every day of the week," end quote. The university says Green's comments didn't influence their decision to drop the violations. They said in a statement, quote, "Student conduct decisions are and have always been made independently and are completely unrelated to any comments by Councillor Green or other external political statements," end quote.
Oregon has hit a recycling milestone by saving 10 million gallons of paint from the landfill. Experts share why and how to recycle paint. Isabel Charlet gives us the details.
Oregonians have now recycled more than 10 million gallons of leftover paint through the nonprofit Paint Care. The Paint Care program allows people to recycle paint for free by dropping off leftover cans at sites across the state, mostly in paint and hardware stores. Lauren Scher is the Oregon and Washington program manager for Paint Care, which was established by paint manufacturers. She says the first step is to always consider if paint can be reused. If not, recycling is the next best choice.
Taking all that paint and making it into a new product, which then could be sold at a price point that is available to everybody. And what we can't recycle, we'll make sure that it's properly disposed of.
Last year alone, Oregonians recycled nearly 650,000 gallons of paint, keeping it out of the waste stream and giving it a second life through recycling and reuse. PaintCare has recycled almost 78 million gallons of paint through 11 programs nationwide since it launched in 2012. Scher says PaintCare's drop-off sites are placed strategically throughout the state, with almost all Oregon residents living within 15 miles of one.
By setting up more than 200 drop-off sites throughout the state, PaintCare made it easily accessible to all Oregonians.
To find the drop-off site nearby, visit paintcare.org. Each site accepts up to 5 gallons, and some will take more. The program also offers free pickup for businesses with 100 gallons or more of extra paint. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Budget cuts abound in all levels of government this year, including at Multnomah County. County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson released her proposed budget last week, and it means 10% cuts for most county departments. That's equivalent to over 100 full-time jobs. Under the plan, the district attorney's office would cut 2% of its over $54 million budget, a smaller share than most other departments. Multnomah County District Attorney Nathan Vasquez is not happy about that, calling out the budget cuts in his department when he asked for more spending. He says homeless services should be on the chopping block, not funds for the district attorney. After the budget was announced, Vasquez called a press conference saying Vega Peterson's cuts hurt public safety and arguing he needs more to add over $4 million to his department. Vega Peterson said the stunt left her, quote, disgusted. She released a statement after Vasquez's press conference saying, quote, no one jumps the line and gets special treatment because they go to TV and talk loudly, end quote. Multnomah County's first public budget hearing will be on May 14th at the Multnomah County Boardroom.
Russian President Vladimir Putin declared a unilateral 72-hour ceasefire in Ukraine in celebration of Victory Day in World War II. Ukraine is calling for a longer, immediate truce rather than waiting until next week as Russia proposed. The Kremlin said the truce, ordered on so-called humanitarian grounds, will start on May 8th and last through the end of May 10th. The purpose is to mark Russia's defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945. Ukraine had already agreed to the U.S. proposal of a full 30-day ceasefire. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andrei Sybiha said, quote, why wait for May 8th? If we can cease fire now, from any date, and for 30 days, so that it is real and not just for a parade, end quote. He did not say whether or not Ukraine is ready to accept Putin's proposal. Putin had previously announced a unilateral 30-day Easter ceasefire, which was well received by Ukraine. But Ukraine and Russia both claimed the other side continued to attack. Up until now, Putin has refused to accept a complete, unconditional end to hostilities. American military aid has been crucial for Ukraine's war effort, and further help could be at risk if the Trump administration stops attempting to assist in ending the war. Trump said over the weekend he harbors doubts about Putin's sincerity in pursuing any kind of deal as Russian forces continue to strike civilian areas of Ukraine while the talks proceeded. Western European officials have accused the Kremlin of slowing down peace talks so that Russia's largest forces could seize more Ukrainian land. Ukraine, meanwhile, has balked at surrendering land to Russia in return for peace, which Trump has indicated could be necessary. Another key point of leverage for Ukraine could be a deal with Washington that grants access to the country's critical mineral wealth.
A judge blocks use of a wartime law for deportations. ICE is criticized for deporting U.S. citizens' children, and President Trump's approval rating is down at the 100-day mark. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The Alien Enemies Act, the statute that grants this wartime power, applies only when there's a declared war or an invasion or predatory incursion against the United States by a foreign nation or government.
Tim McDonald with the ACLU in Colorado is praising a federal judge there, one of several temporarily blocking the administration from deporting migrants under a 1798 law. President Donald Trump wants to use the Alien Enemies Act against what he calls an invasion by gangs, but courts are saying it can only be used against an enemy nation during a declared war. Meanwhile, immigration officials are under fire for deporting three U.S. citizen children, one of them a four-year-old with cancer, alongside their Honduran-born mothers. On CBS, Border Czar Tom Homan blamed the parents, saying having a child in the country is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. New surveys show Trump's approval rating falling to historic lows at the 100-day mark of his second term. Two polls put his support at about 40% over concerns about immigration policies and the economy. Congressional Republicans look split over a plan to cut nearly $900 billion from Medicaid. A dozen moderates say they will kill any budget that undermines the health care program crucial for people in their districts who are poor, elderly, rural, or have a disability. And Myra Alvarez with the Children's Partnership says it's also important for schools.
Medicaid is the third largest source of funding for K through 12 public schools to help children have access to routine health screenings, preventive services, and physical, speech, and occupational therapy.
The League of Women Voters of Arkansas is suing the state's top election official. The group's Kristen Foster says Secretary of State Cole Jester should not enforce new laws which put up unconstitutional barriers for ballot initiatives.
They have put so many restrictions on, and they are so layered and complex that the ability to just get a petition out in the field and let people sign it is nearly impossible.
Jester defends the changes as necessary for election integrity. Although the Heritage Foundation has recorded only 5 voter fraud convictions in the state in the past 2 decades. Congress is expected to vote this week on a proposal to deny states the authority to set clean vehicle standards. Robert McCracken, energy manager for the city of Cincinnati, says local governments are already seeing benefits from electric vehicles.
We're also seeing lower maintenance costs. Our total cost of ownership has looked pretty good since we've had some of these electric vehicles. We do have goals for the city that by 2035, we will have a 100% clean fuels fleet.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with the co-founder of Frog Ferry, a campaign to create a ferry route in the Willamette River between Vancouver, Washington, and Oregon City. Then we'll speak with professor and author Ned Blackhawk on his writings about Native American history in the Pacific Northwest. At 6, it's Labor Radio. And at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with an overnight low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow's weather has a chance of rain and a high of 65. Today in history, in 1967, fighter Muhammad Ali refuses his induction into the United States Army during the Vietnam War. He was subsequently stripped of his championship and license. The quote of the day is from Mr. Ali, who said, "Service to others is the rent you pay for your room here on Earth." We're giving him a bonus today. Ali also said, "Impossible is temporary."
Young athletes competed this weekend at the 2025 Native Youth Olympics in Anchorage, Alaska. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The weekend of Native Youth Olympic Games wrapped up in Anchorage, Alaska on Saturday. The event lets young athletes from around the state connect and showcase their skills in competitions rooted in indigenous practices. The Alaska Desk's Alona Nyden reports.
Come on, Daisy!
With much fanfare, Daisy Van Blarkum prepares for the final one-foot high kick competition in the Native Youth Olympics on Saturday. She hits 87 inches, which goes above her personal record, and wins her first place. The bleachers are filled with people from all corners of Alaska, but are familiar faces to Van Blarkum. She says making friends with other athletes and coaches is a part of her success.
I compete a lot better when I know everybody and when I'm comfortable around everyone.
The Native Youth Olympics is a three-day event in which high school students participate in a dozen competitions, each representing a different Alaska Native subsistence activity or skill. Joanna Hobson is one of the coaches working to revive the games in Alaska's North Slope. She says this helps reserved students come out of their shell.
As they're starting to learn more of their cultural games, they're starting to learn that courage, they're starting to learn what it means to be who you are, to accept who you are, where you're at, and then to grow from that.
Anchorage athlete Anastasia Wild took second place in a two-foot high kick competition. Like other athletes, she says she loves the community aspect of the games.
We're participating together and not apart, and you get to connect with other people and make new friends, and it's not about winning. It's about beating your personal records and improving not for yourself, but improving for the others around you.
The event started more than 50 years ago with a few dozen participants. This year, the games brought together about 450 athletes, a record number since the COVID-19 pandemic. In Anchorage, I am Alona Nyden.
An Indigenous woman in Manitoba has recently made history by becoming a First Nations youngest ever chief. She has also become the first woman elected to the role. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
Trishelle Bunn is a 25-year-old third-year law student at the University of Manitoba. She was recently named chief of the Birdtail Sioux Dakota First Nation, about 75 miles northwest of Brandon, Manitoba, after beating her opponent with nearly 69% of the vote. She's not without some experience, though. Bunn has just ended her term as the Southern Chiefs Organization's youth chief. She says that gave her some knowledge about what to expect in everyday governance and decision-making. Bunn says being elected to the position of chief is the greatest honor of her life.
In my previous role as a youth chief of the Southern Chiefs organization, I spoke to the importance of youth in leadership, and I think this is a testament to that. I think, you know, our young people today are really leading that way. We're entering those leadership spaces, and our voices really need to be heard, and they deserve to be at every table. And I think my community really spoke to that last night, the way that they voted, that they wanted, you know, someone young and a young voice to lead our people.
Bunn says although she's the first young leader, she won't be the last. She has pledged greater transparency and accountability for her four-year term as chief. She says she's also heard from community members who want more of a say in the First Nations decision-making. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And several groups are marking today, April 28th, as Autism Awareness Day for Native Americans. While Native children aren't seen as necessarily having higher rates of autism than other groups, a 2023 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association shows that they, as well as Alaska Natives, Pacific Islander, and Native Hawaiians, have the least access to autism resources per child compared to others. Groups like Dine Parents Taking Action at Northern Arizona University are promoting more awareness of autism in Native communities. This follows recent events like the 4th Annual Autism Awareness Walk in Nevada, which involved the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
The Portland driver who ran over a pedestrian with his truck and tried to hit a cyclist in 2022 was sentenced to 17 and a half years in prison. Frederick Moore, driving a GMC truck, rammed Vincent Timothy, who was walking on the sidewalk, and dragged him underneath the vehicle. Moore then tried to hit a bicyclist who was yelling at him and drove off. The manager of a nearby food cart pod followed Moore and was able to relay his license plate number to police. Moore was found guilty of first-degree manslaughter, attempted murder, and two counts of failure to perform the duties of a driver. He'll serve 17 and a half years for the charges, the maximum allowed. Prosecutors still don't know what motivated the crimes.
As spring starts, people may expect their seasonal depression to subside, but that's not always the case. Sometimes feelings don't meet expectations, causing further stress and anxiety. Zamon Perez has more in Maryland.
As spring weather starts in Maryland, some might think seasonal depression and other issues related to weather might subside, but one expert explains that's not always the case. Budding flowers, warmer temperatures, and longer days are welcome signs to many after the long, dark months of winter. Some people might believe warmer weather improves mental health after seasonal depression in the winter months, but that's not always the case. Many people experience increased mental health struggles as spring rolls around. Cynthia Cubbage with the Barker Adoption Foundation says when people's feeling in the springtime doesn't meet their expectations, it can make mental health issues worse.
When people are looking forward to spring because it's a time of renewal and those expectations don't happen and nothing really gets better for them because it's deeper than that, then they get really stressed and depression can really set in. And it's because of the expectations.
Suicide rates rise in the spring and not winter, according to Johns Hopkins Medicine. Researchers find that seasonal allergies play a role. A person with rhinitis, which causes allergy symptoms, is more than 40% more likely to be depressed. Cubbage says there are many ways people can combat those feelings. Get outdoors as much as possible and get out socially as well. But she reminds folks that sleep is vital.
Definitely prioritize sleep. Even though we're having more daylight, it kind of makes people want to stay up longer. They should still be doing things. And to remember that, you know, that's a big transition for your body. They should still prioritize their sleep. So if they were still going to sleep at 8 or they were putting their kids down at 8, that should continue.
Cubbage adds that if you continue to feel depressed or down even after trying those suggestions, it's best to seek out professional mental health help. I'm Zamon Perez, Maryland News Connection.
Without the Secure Rural Schools and Communities Act, rural schools in Washington State face uncertainty. The program helps counties with high percentages of public land offset lost timber revenue, but experts warn it isn't a long-term fix. Isabel Charlet has more.
Education leaders want Congress to reauthorize the Secure Rural Schools and Communities Act, though they say it's not a long-term solution. For decades, the program, known as SRS, has funded schools and roads in more than 700 counties, like Washington's Skamania County, hit by declining timber revenue from federal land. Mark Haggerty with the Center for American Progress says the funding has served as a lifeline for school districts in forest counties that can't rely on the timber industry anymore.
So the industry doesn't support local schools, sheriff's departments anymore. And so if you just look at the way the economy actually works, it doesn't work for rural places.
Experts say SRS can't keep supporting rural schools because the funding keeps shrinking and is unreliable. Despite a reauthorization mandate every 3 years, the act died without a vote in the House of Representatives last year after unanimous approval by the Senate. SRS was originally authorized through 2006, after which counties were expected to find new ways to pay for infrastructure. But Haggerty says many haven't been able to do so. This was the case in Skamania County, which went from 40% of local income coming from timber in the 1980s to just 1% today.
The rural, isolated, timber-dependent communities effectively didn't recover.
Haggerty advocates for a new approach, a permanent trust to stabilize funding for rural forest communities. Under this model, he says the money earned from timber would be held and invested to generate income, which would then be paid back to the rural forest counties that supplied the timber. This story was produced with original reporting from Claire Carlson and Lane Wendell Fisher for The Daily Yonder. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Scientists are working to develop climate-friendlier rice. Rice fields are a major source of planet-warming methane, but a new variety could help change that. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Curry, stir-fry, sushi, jambalaya, whatever's on the menu tonight, there's a good chance it includes rice.
Rice is consumed by many people on Earth.
And Anna Schnurr of the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences says demand for the grain is growing as populations rise. But producing rice typically emits a lot of methane, a powerful global warming gas. The methane is produced by microorganisms that thrive in the flooded fields where rice is grown. They break down organic compounds that are secreted by the rice plant's roots and in the process release methane. So Schnurr and her team identified a rice variety that naturally produces much less of one of those organic compounds, but it does not produce large harvests.
Then we crossbred this variety with a high-yielding commercial variety, and by doing so we could get new varieties that both had high yield and low methane production.
She says one variety they've tested produces about 70% less methane.
It really reduced the methane emissions a lot.
She hopes that in a few years it will be commercially available, so farmers can grow more rice for the world without creating a lot more climate pollution. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 28th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, Annette Newell, and Kenny. Their producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Zimone Perez, Brian Bull, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO Evening News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last week, supporters of Frog Ferry rallied for financial support at the Capitol in Salem. Frog Ferry is a nonprofit working to bring electric ferries on the Willamette River from Vancouver, Washington to Oregon City. I spoke with Frog Fairy's founder and president, Susan Bladholm. For folks who do not know, what is Frog Fairy?
So Frog Fairy is a nonprofit grassroots effort to put an electric passenger ferry on the Willamette River. Actually proposed 9 stops from Vancouver, Washington, down to Oregon City.
That sounds pretty good. And how would the ferry fit into the regional transportation network?
Well, we actually got our start working with ODOT, PBOT, TriMet, and Metro. And so the 9 stops that we have, it was really up to those transit agencies to come up with them. And they based their decision on how it currently interfaces with the rest of the transit network and where there is ample demand. So we created an operational feasibility study back in, I think it was 2019, and it's out on our website, and it shows how it connects and integrates to the rest of the transit system.
And has there been other ferries that existed in Portland and Vancouver before Frog Ferry?
There have. And so residents of the Portland area will recognize like the word Boone's Ferry Road or Taylor's Ferry Road. You know, these are roads that used to match up to ferry landings. And there used to be a ferry that connected from Vancouver, Washington, up to the northern part of Portland, just crisscrossing the Columbia River. And that was over 100 years ago, the same month that we opened the I-5 bridge, because we had this new thing called the automobile, the same month that we shut down that ferry system.
Ah. And you mentioned that you are at the state capitol today, and what are you asking for at the state capitol?
So we have requests into state legislators. There is a 2025 transportation package being considered by our elected leaders. We have a request in for funding there. The total request we're asking for the state is $10 million. So we've got a request in there. And then we also have a capital construction request in as well. So right now we're pursuing the 2 different avenues of funding with the state with hope that one of those will work out for us.
And what has the reaction been from lawmakers so far?
Well,